chairwoman, I always say that county chair is the unsung hero in so many ways of politics. So thanks for what you and your committee do. Thank you to Ronan and our fantastic team. I hope you get to know our organizers on the ground. And a very big thank you for taking the time to spend a little part of the afternoon together talking about where our country is headed and what it's going to take to win not just the next election, but the next era for the values that we share. I'm so thrilled to be with you. I'm sorry we're running a little bit behind. We were having a very authentic experience with one of your swinging truss bridges. But we made it. We've been full of authentic experiences the last couple days. We were at the State Fair yesterday. Had something called a bacon ball BLT. Still not sure exactly what all went into it, but it was delicious. And so glad to be able to spend some time with you establishing that there is no such thing as an all-Republican county or state anywhere in this union. That the values that bring us together and motivate us to be involved in politics are American values. That ideas like freedom are not conservative but American values that also have progressive implications when we take them seriously. Our campaign is built around the idea that if we want to have real freedom in this country, then that means you've got to have health care, because you're not free if you don't. That's freedom too. That there's more to freedom than cutting a regulation on a bank somewhere or cutting a tax on a corporation somewhere. That if we really want to be free, we got to make sure that if you work full time in this country, you can put food on the table and you're not living in poverty. We believe freedom means that women can make their own healthcare decisions without male bosses or politicians telling them what to do. That individuals can decide who they want to marry without a county clerk telling them who to marry. That freedom comes by way of the ability to organize, which is why we stand with organized labor in insisting on higher wages and better working conditions. And the freedom comes by way of education, which is why it's time for a Secretary of Education who believes in public education. We believe delivering security for the American people takes a lot more than thumping your chest and saying, I alone can fix it, or telling Americans who disagree with you to go back to where they came from. That's not the patriotism I grew up with. Patriotism lies in insisting that our country can and should be better than it's ever been each passing day. And security requires that we prepare for the actual threats that are going to be in front of us, which are not always threats that can be dealt with by putting up a 17th century security technology like a wall from coast to coast. It's going to take a little more than that. We want to keep each other safe in this century. That means keeping each other safe from things like white nationalist violence that has been claiming lives in this country and around the world. It means taking steps to make sure that the Second Amendment is never twisted into a failure to deliver common sense gun safety that will save lives in our schools and our communities across the country. And in this river community, we got to face up to the fact that security in the 21st century means dealing with climate change and stopping it from causing any more disasters in our time. Now, it isn't just about what we believe, it's about what we're going to do. And it's why we put forward plans on everything from a national service vision to create 1 million paid service year opportunities for young people across this country, to a vision on dealing with systemic racism that is as ambitious as the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Western Europe, but we're going to do it right here in the United States this time, to a vision on rural health care that sees to it that we stop seeing our providers disappear and our rural hospitals close across Iowa and across America. Today we've had the privilege of traveling this state, rolling out our plan to build up rural economies, making sure that we invest in infrastructure that we rely on to build up our communities, that we invest in education and deal with the teacher shortage that far too many rural communities are living with, to make sure that we invest in digital infrastructure so that everybody can be connected to the internet, every single American, and we can do it if we're willing to invest, and recognizing that we need not only economic growth strategies, but population growth strategies, which is why we should welcome immigration in rural America to help build our communities up and lift them into the 21st century. But you all have been waiting very patiently, and I really want this to be a conversation. So instead of a long monologue, I'm going to wrap it up right there and would love to speak with you about any issues that are on your mind and take as many questions as time will allow us. All right, Medicare, thank you. So in this country, if you do not have health insurance, you're going to pay way too much for health care. And if you do have health insurance, you're probably paying way too much for health care. We need a better system. Now, the Affordable Care Act went a long way. My mother-in-law is alive because of the Affordable Care Act. It's one of the reasons why I'm upset that this administration, while pretending that they're going to keep things like pre-existing condition protections, is actually undermining every turn they get. But that's not enough. We got to make sure that every single American has access to health care, because why should we settle for less? If people in every other developed country in the world have access to universal health care, why should we accept not having it in the greatest country in the world? It's just not right. Now, where I part company with some others in the party is I don't believe it's going to be as easy as flipping a switch. I believe that anyone who allows the words Medicare for All to escape their lips, who talks about that vision, which I share, of universal health care, has to talk about how you're going to get from here to there. And the way I propose we do it is what I would call Medicare for All Who Want It. In other words, we take something like Medicare, an improved version of Medicare, we make it available on the exchanges, you can buy into it if you want. Now, I'm pretty sure it's going to be better and more competitive than any of the corporate options out there, because it's going to have more buying power, and it's not going to be concerned about delivering profits to its executives and shareholders. But you can decide that. Buy into this plan if you think it's the right one. If the old one's fine, that's not a problem for us. However, I do believe that if people like me are right, when we say these plans will be more effective and more cost efficient, then it becomes the pathway that gets you to Medicare for All, because more and more people are going to vote with their feet. That's how I believe we get the job done, get everybody covered, and see to it that another generation doesn't come up wondering whether they're going to be able to get care. And I know this is a huge issue in rural parts of the country in particular, because you got so many folks working in agriculture who then have to have another job just for the health care benefits. You ought to be able to buy in whether you are a single sole proprietorship or whether you work at a large organization, and it shouldn't matter in terms of your ability to get health care. That's what we're going to deliver with this Medicare for All Who Want It vision. Yes, ma'am.
All PTSD for our emergency medical services.
Thank you.
Firefighters,
we're out yeah. there working hard, and when we get PTSD, they're just like, okay, what about our benefits? Can we afford to take care of our families?
That's right. Well, first of all, thank you for speaking up on that. Are you involved in first response? Or? Both of you. Well, thanks for what you do. Look, when it comes to first responders, whether we're talking about paramedics, firefighters, police, there's so much. And by the way, I haven't heard the very latest, but I'm really disturbed by what we're hearing out of Philadelphia. It sounds like a number of officers have been injured. And the situation's developing right now. And I know it's got a lot of people in first responder families holding on tight to their loved ones. There's so much emphasis on your health from the neck down, right? We talk about PT, we talk about making sure you're trained up that way, very little on mental health. And we got to break the silence about mental health. You know, we're getting better at this, slowly but surely. When I came back from Afghanistan, we were doing a better job than we did a generation ago on encouraging people to talk about it, but it's still something that I think a lot of people hesitate to come forward about. So we got to do something about that culture. And we got to do something about actually providing resources to get treatment for mental health. And that's everything from just a regular checkup on emotional health all the way to dealing with the most serious and severe symptoms. And on the books, it says there's parity, right? You're supposed to take care of mental and physical health, but it doesn't actually work that way, does it? For one thing, it's hard to find a provider who's in your network. or the wait list is so long that you don't know when you're going to get seen. That's why, and we'll be doing more that we're going to roll out in the next few weeks on this subject, but the basic idea is that we've got to care for people at every stage of their mental health journey, and we'll know we're getting somewhere when it's just as routine to get an emotional health checkup as it is getting a physical. And in our schools, you're just as liable to be able to see somebody for mental health support as you do a school nurse for your physical health. That's how we'll know we're getting to where we need to be. In the meantime, thanks for what you do to take care of others in this community. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. The question about tariffs and the farm economy. And folks are getting killed. I was talking to a lot of soy farmers today. And you got enough to worry about, especially between the weather we had this year and the price fluctuations, without having to wonder whether a tweet is going to destabilize the market as well. And now you got these tariffs going on. They are making it harder and harder for American farmers to be able to export. And American farming requires that we have export markets, whether you're talking about soy or pork or any of the other things we're growing here in the Midwest and around the country. Now, it seems to me that the president's message is basically, look, you got to take one for the team. And I guess the idea was if you take that short-term pain, things are going to get better. Problem is, I'm not sure how short-term that pain is, and I'm not sure what team he's talking about, because he's pitting us against each other right now. It's coming down on farmers. It's coming down on workers, on consumers. Do you see they're going to let the next round of tariffs wait till Christmas? I'm pretty sure we're still going to need to put food on the table and make our budgets balance at our homes after Christmas, just like we are before. I'm glad he's finally admitting that it's going to be a hit to our pocketbooks. But the idea that that's going to make it any better shows you that they don't actually care about us. Now, it'd be one thing if this was part of a strategy, right? If there was a plan to make sure we could get China to behave better through tariffs. But the Chinese government is not going to change their fundamental economic model because we put a couple tariffs there to poke them in the eye. What they're going to do is they're going to poke right back. And that's what's happening. And we're paying the price, especially here in the heartland. A real strategy for dealing with China means investing in our domestic competitiveness, making sure we have the roads and the bridges and the technologies and the education and the health so that we can compete better. And then we'll find ways to contain what they're doing that's creating so many problems, but not by asking Americans to pay a price for it. That's not a strategy. That's not a plan. And the fact that he's letting it come down on our backs, whether it's consumers, whether it's workers, whether it's farmers, shows that this president does not have our best interests at heart.
Our current president seems to be bent on destroying the climate control. Now, weakening the Endangered Animal Act, pouring the mask to help get back to those being improved.
Yes, ma'am. The question is about climate and also things like the Endangered Species Act that the president's weakening. You know, the eagle, the symbol of our country, is supposed to be something you'd be protecting. And so is our climate. And by the way, to me, this isn't just about protecting the planet. This is about protecting each other. This is about protecting people, living, breathing people, especially the youngest among us, who are going to spend the rest of their lives dealing with the consequences of more floods, more trouble for crops, more extreme weather, more wildfires, more rising sea levels in some cities, unless we do something. The thing is, we know what to do. We got to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. We got to price carbon, and then we can have a dividend that sends the money right back out to the American people from the carbon price. We got to research renewable energy, which is already creating so many jobs across Iowa when you look at the wind farms and solar. And there are some steps that don't get talked about as much that involve rural America. You know, I think a lot of rural Americans feel like they're being told they're part of the problem when it comes to climate. But the reality, nobody has more at stake. And if we get soil management right, there is the ability of soil. You all right? Okay. There's the ability of soil to take in as much carbon as the global transportation sector is putting out. We just haven't worked out all the technology to do. We should be researching that and compensating farmers when we ask them to adopt more sustainable practices. In the same way that, you know, we're so proud that Norman Borlaug, the agronomist from Iowa, developed the Green Revolution that saved a billion lives by creating crop techniques that were spread across the world. We ought to be just as proud as what we pioneer right here in the heartland when it comes to climate and have that spread around the world too. And just one other thing I want to mention, because lately religion's been talked about like it belongs on one side of the aisle. Like if you're religious, you got to be right wing. Well, there's a lot about the stewardship of creation that is in Scripture that I don't see being honored by the administration right now. Not to mention the stuff about loving your neighbor and taking care of the least among us and feeding the poor and clothing the naked and welcoming the stranger. This is an opportunity to think about how we make good on those values too. Thank you. Is that on your mind too, sir?
Same
question. Okay. So thoughts and prayers aren't going to be enough. And there used to be this kind of, well, I don't know what to call it other than a political correctness that said that when there's a shooting, we're not allowed to talk about gun safety reform until a certain amount of time has passed. You know, don't do it right after a shooting. The problem is there's no such thing as a moment that doesn't come right after a shooting in America today. It's happening every day in our communities, including my city. And it's happening in these mass shootings like what happened in Dayton and El Paso and what may be unfolding before our eyes in Philadelphia as we get more information about that. And thoughts and prayers aren't going to do it. Now, we can honor the Second Amendment and still have some common sense. That means universal background checks, something that 94% of Americans want, most Republicans, most gun owners, most Democrats, most Americans, and Washington can't deliver. How can it be that many Americans want something to happen and Washington can't get it done? Well, it tells you what's broken in our system right now. So we've got to have background checks. We've got to have red flag laws so you can get an extreme risk protection order. If somebody's a danger to themselves or has a history of domestic violence or is connected to a hate group, they shouldn't be able to get a gun. This is common sense. And I believe, as somebody who carried weapons of war and encountered a lot of these things overseas, there are weapons that have no place on the streets of American neighborhoods in peacetime, and we ought to be ready to do something about that.
Yes, I applaud you for your rollout of the $800 billion rural initiative. It's a great step, especially going after getting all of us connected to the internet. That's a fantastic future. Right behind you flows an engine of commerce that accounts for $400 billion. And down that river and 1.3 million jobs. What are you going to do to ensure that we get the necessary infrastructure redesign on this river to get it modernized?
Thank you. Hopefully everybody was able to hear that. It's about the importance. Digital infrastructure is great, but we got just regular infrastructure needs a lot of attention too. And a country like ours ought to be able to do this, but we're not making the investment. You know, I'll be honest, the one area where this president had me fooled was around infrastructure. Remember that big infrastructure plan they were talking about a couple years ago? I actually thought they might do it, if only to just kind of juice the economy and help the numbers look good. I thought they were maybe actually going to do that plan. And when it actually came out, it turned out the plan was, you know, mayors and states and counties had to do all the work like usual. Well, that's how it already works. And we don't have enough funded. We've got to upgrade the infrastructure that makes America work. That's what makes us competitive. And when China is putting, last time I saw, about $4 trillion in their Belt and Road Initiative in infrastructure in other countries, just in order to get new allies, it seems like they're willing to do more out of their central government around the world than we're willing to do out of our federal government to help folks right here in Iowa and where I come from. And we can't go on like this. So we need to be ready to make an investment. Yes, it's going to cost money. But unlike tax cuts on the wealthiest, these are investments that actually pay back and make a return. And that's everything from the roads and the river infrastructure and the railways and the stuff you don't see. The underground infrastructure, water, wastewater, doesn't get nearly as much attention until there's a failure and people can't drink the water. This is another thing that, to me, it's just a matter of freedom. You're not free in life if you're not confident that a glass of clean, safe drinking water is going to come out of this tap every day. But that's going to require investment. We ought to be ready to do it. I've also proposed as part of our rural plan that we have resiliency support for communities where we know, no matter how good of a job we do on climate, we're going to continue to see, most likely, increased issues with flooding and other weather events. And we got to prepare for it, and that's going to require federal help. Straight to death.
chair, Pete, I think everybody here is going to agree that America is one of the greatest countries in the world. We have a tremendous amount of resources, but we also have a tremendous amount of waste. So one of the things that I've found and seen a lot of different candidates, but nobody talks about the waste that we already have, how we get rid of that, and redirect those resources to something productive.
Yeah, there's no question that we got a lot of processes that generate waste or harm, especially in the way that our economy works today. The good news is there's a lot of jobs to be created in finding a better way. We try to use resources as wisely as possible in our community, just in running the city. We take the yard waste that comes off people's lawns and we turn it into something that people can then buy and put out in their fields. We harvest the methane that comes off of our digester in our wastewater plant, and we pipe it into the trucks that pick up that yard waste and trash. My public work director calls it the poop to power plant. And we need to find ways to do that as an economy. Now, if we have things like carbon pricing, that'll do some of it, because you'll see you'll get an economic reward for being more efficient. But we've also just got to make sure that this is part of our culture. And I think it's an example of where leadership from the top really makes a difference.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was actually speaking about spending waste.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I was in the military. I've seen just how effectively our government can waste American taxpayer dollars. I saw in Kandahar, I think it was, there was a whole building. It was like $30 million. And they put it up, and it came in so late and so far out of the specs that they had in mind that no sooner was it up than they started talking about tearing it back down. I'm not sure anybody ever even went and worked in it. I mean, you put a drink in any supply officer, it could be a Diet Coke, and that'll stay. It won't take much to get them to tell you a story about how they've seen that kind of waste. And we see it in a lot of different functions across our government. Now, I still think cutting waste alone isn't going to do it. We're going to need some revenue. Things like closing corporate tax loopholes and asking the very wealthiest among us to pay their share. But there's also no question that we got to. Well, you're right. There's no question that we can run a lot of our operations more efficiently. Again, as a mayor, I've had to do it just to keep our city going. Because, you know, when we run out of revenue for something, I don't get to print money or create a giant deficit. We just have to figure it out. And there are a lot of processes where we are paying too much, whether it's Medicare, which needs to be made much more efficient and can be, through technology as well as through policies like allowing them to actually negotiate drug prices. Or whether it's what's going on in some of our administrative functions. And the more we can simplify and clean it up, the better it's going to be for everybody. One of the things in our plan that came out today is a process just to have a simpler way of applying for federal grant funds. Because a lot of effort gets wasted, and even money gets wasted, in chasing after all of the different versions of the different kinds of paperwork. And a lot of towns don't have a full-time grant writer who can sort through it all. So we're going to create a common application with input from the kinds of communities we want to apply for these funds on how we could streamline the process so that there's less waste and fewer communities get discouraged from applying at all in order to get those kinds of benefits. Just one example of what happens when you come into government with the mentality that we've got to make it work better and more efficiently for all of us. Yes, sir. The way I asked the question captures it perfectly. You know, the world needs America right now. It needs American values, the best kind of American values. It needs someone to be out there promoting freedom and democracy. You look at what they're struggling for in Hong Kong today. You look at what's going on in Russia, where people are taken to the streets of Moscow demanding better. You look at the behavior of Saudi Arabia right now. There is no question that the world needs America on the world stage. Trouble is, it can't be just any America. It only works if we're actually living those values here at home. And right now, we've got an administration that doesn't show a lot of interest in things like freedom of the press. And we can't go out there and stand up to authoritarians and dictators if we're using the exact same language as they are, that any unfavorable news coverage is fake news. We can't be convincing. We can't be convincing when we talk about political freedom and freedom of expression if somebody who's critical of their president here at home gets the response of send her back. It's not right. So in the end, America can either resent the rest of the world or we can lead the rest of the world, but we can't do both. And I think that an America that actually lives up to our values, the kind of America and the kind of American administration I seek to create, will honor both at home and abroad the idea of freedom of expression, the idea of freedom of the press, the idea of freedom of religion. That religion is never used as a cudgel to beat somebody else over the head with. And honoring those values at home makes us more credible abroad, and that in the long run actually makes us more secure and safe here at home too, in my view. That's me. So what's going on at the southern border is a stain on our country, and it's being done in our name, and it's being done with our tax dollars. Now, what's happening is a mixture of two different things, cruelty and incompetence. I say incompetence because this is not the first time we've had this many folks coming at the border. But it is the first time we've seen this level of inhumanity in the way people are being kept, hearing about children dying. The idea that a child would come fleeing, seeking asylum, lawfully, by the way, and lose their life. A little kid fleeing violence ought to have nothing to fear from the greatest country on earth. And the greatest country on earth has nothing to fear from a kid fleeing violence. So, day one, we eliminate the policy of family separation once and for all. We reestablish the family case management program that has a very good track record of people being able to get to their hearings, but without tearing them up or detaining them in the meantime. And we put an end to for-profit child detention centers, because nobody ought to make a buck on somebody being kept in a cage. We move these functions out of the Department of Justice or Customs and Border Protection when it comes to housing people and move it into Health and Human Services. And then for the long run, we work to make sure that people can prosper in their own countries so they never feel that their life depends on coming to ours. Yes, sir. I'll give you the long answer in a minute, but the short answer is pay teachers more. You know, teachers get paid less than people with comparable qualifications in comparable job positions. And for the first time, I think ever, a majority of teachers surveyed said that they would suggest their kids not follow that profession. That is trouble. That is trouble for this whole country. If we're not recruiting and retaining the best to have such an important job. Other countries do. I'll tell you a story about a family in South Bend that likes to host exchange students from Japan, which has a famously good education system. And they had a student staying with them. She was getting ready to go to college, but she's in high school. And she wanted to be a teacher. That was her dream. And she spent her semester here, you know, in South Bend as an exchange student, went back, and they kept in touch with her. And they heard back from her that she took the exam to get into the program to start to become a teacher, but she came up short. She's very bright, but just a little bit shy of the bar to become a teacher. And she did what a lot of people in Japan would do if you're good but not quite good enough academically to become a teacher. She became a doctor. That was her fallback plan. But that's partly because they have compensation for teachers that reflects how much of a priority it is in society. Now, that's not the only thing we got to do. There's a lot of steps we got to take. But one of the biggest is simply paying teachers more. And I propose that we have a federal fund focused on Title I schools, where we know it would make the biggest difference with the students in the most need, to supplement teacher pay. I also believe that we've got to expand the loan forgiveness program so that if you run up a big student debt, like my husband did, becoming a teacher, you can work it off by being a teacher. We need to be encouraging more people to do this. Great. if you couldn't hear from here, that the question was about automation in the workplace and whether universal basic income might be part of the solution. So we've got to prepare for automation radically changing what it's like to work in this country. A lot of the tasks that we count on now just won't be needed in the same way in a few years. And it's not all blue-collar work. It's everything from radiologists to people who produce financial reports in white-collar jobs, all the way to somebody taking an order at McDonald's. These jobs will change. Now, doesn't mean all the jobs go away. It means that the part that you repeat all the time, that's the part that can be done by a machine. The part that's going to become more important than ever is the part where you got to think about something's different this time, when there's a pattern that gets broken, or just dealing with human beings. That's the part that gets more important. So we got to educate for that. We got to teach more critical thinking. We got to teach more social and emotional learning. I'm interested in these experiments that are going on with basic income. They're trying it out. My friend, the mayor of Stockton, California, has an experiment going on where he lives. And I'd like to see the information come back. But while that is an interesting thing to look at, I also think we just got to make sure the fundamentals of our economy are set up right, so that if you work a job in this country, you're not poor. And we're not there right now. The idea that you would need to get a second or a third job when you're working and you're good at it, no matter what the job is, doesn't make any sense. It's why we got to have a higher minimum wage. It's why we got to have the right kind of labor protection. And since automation and other things are changing the way we work, we got to protect gig workers and not just full-time workers. We got to get rid of this magic that says only if you work 40 hours a week for an employer as an employee are you entitled to protections and benefits and vacation and the rest of it. But if you're a contractor, or if you're stringing together two or three jobs at a time or a gig and a couple of jobs, too bad. No. Under my plan, if you drive 7 hours a week for Uber, then 7 divided by 40 is how much they ought to be helping with your retirement and how much you ought to pay into a sick leave bank, so that everybody gets those kinds of benefits. And that's part of how we prepare for those changes, I think, in the workplace that are coming our way. Oh, just one more? All right. Yes, ma'am.
You're in Keokuk, and Keokuk, within the last, say, 10 years, has really suffered some major blows. They've had a couple of plants closed down, and nothing new came in its place. And if you even make, let's take, say you go 100 miles from here, you're going to see that same story. There's no job. You're talking about how to improve what people are working, what they're going to get paid. But a lot of towns, there just aren't any jobs. So, and Hillary Clinton addressed it a little bit. She said, you know, we need to, like, coal's not coming back. So we need to come up with new jobs to help the people in coal country. So that was the people in the coal country, and we're the people in the corn country. So if we're not, if you're not a farmer, you know, you're kind of,
right.
There's not a lot of opportunity here. My own children are not, don't want to stay here. One's a teacher.
Right.
The other two are like, we have to leave in order to find work.
Right.
This is the story of my hometown, too. We just experienced it earlier. So our factories closed in the 60s. And when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, I didn't know that it was unusual to have empty factories or empty houses in your neighborhood or in your community. I just thought it was part of the furniture. Only later, when I went off to college, did I find out that was really something about the industrial Midwest. And now in communities like here, we see that same pressure that's causing us to lose population, and worse, causing a lot of people to lose hope. I think it's part of why we see life expectancy going down. We've got to turn that around, but it can be done. I pointed to what's going on in our city. We've still got our challenges, but our city's growing. And part of how we're growing is that there's jobs being created in industries that didn't exist when we were making cars. We're corn country, just like here. I'm trying to build up a Silicon Prairie in our part of the country by taking advantage of the fact that we're connected to the internet. We got really good fiber, and we've got a really strongly competitive cost of living compared to where a lot of the internet companies are. And some of these investors are looking for somewhere else to go. We can create more jobs. But there's a chicken and an egg thing. If we're going to have job creation strategies, we also got to have a population growth strategy. Because a lot of times when I'm at the table trying to get somebody to move to our community, you know, economic development-wise, exactly, they want to know where the workers are going to come from. And so if we fail to invest in the infrastructure, in education, in health,
then we're not going to have the kind of workforce that makes it possible. And sometimes literally just attracting people. That's what that community renewal visa idea that I've talked about is about. So we got to do all of these things at once. Now, the old model of economic development just focused on the places. It was all about real estate and the buildings. What we've learned is that we've got to invest in places, we also got to invest in people. And if we get that right with investments in human capital and our well-being, then there's no reason that a region like this can't compete. We got fantastic resources. We got great people. We compare pretty favorably in terms of costs to definitely the coasts of this country right now. I don't know if you saw it in San Francisco right now. There's a new style of housing. I don't know if you can call it that even. Instead of a room, you just get a pod. It's basically like a bunk bed. And people are paying like $1,500 a month for this, which where I come from is a lot more than my mortgage. And so sooner or later, this is going to kick in and create a huge amount of potential, but only if we're wired up and able to connect into that bigger economy. It's why the internet part's so important. All of these things fit together. But also, we just got to stand up taller and realize that we can generate our own solutions. I wouldn't be waiting on the state capitol. I definitely wouldn't be waiting on Washington. But when I'm president, Washington will be there to help. And so my message today is help is on the way, but I need your help getting things changed up in Washington where they keep cutting all the resources that make us competitive in the first place. So I gather our time is up, but this is not the last time I'll be in Iowa. I'm so thankful for the warm reception. I'm so thankful for the way that you're coming out and hopefully encouraging your friends and neighbors too. I'm running for office because I'm full of hope. And it's not naive hope. I mean, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of what our country's up against right now. But it's the fact that we live in a country that, at its best moments, has figured out how to take what's wrong and turn it into something better by enlisting one another in that project, by asking one another to be part of it. You don't run for office unless you believe that you can get a hold of those pulleys and levers in our government and use them to make people better off. And redesign them if you have to make people better off. It's an act of hope to run. It's an act of hope to spend time with somebody who's seeking to run. And I hope you will be able to spread that hope with us, spread that sense of urgency with us, and pull more and more people into this process, because the choices we make right now are going to decide whether our country makes it in my lifetime. I'm convinced of it. And to get that done, I need your help. So can I look to you to spread that kind of hope in our communities? And can I look to you to help make sure that we are winning the era when it comes to our values? I can't wait to see you again. We'll be out in this state early and often, and I believe you will help put me in the White House. Thank you so much for the chance to be with you, for what you're doing in this community, and I will see you on the trail. Thank you very much.